Hello and welcome to The Reading Life. This week, the New Orleans literary scene includes a visit from Robert M. Edsel, author of Saving Italy, The Race to Rescue a Nation's Treasures from the Nazis. He's coming to speak in the National World War II Museum for a lecture that's co-sponsored by WWNO. Edsel will also be talking about his work on The Monuments Men, a bestseller being turned into a feature film. We'll also hear from Nessim Hickson, one of the creators of the very beautiful new book, Love Letters from New Orleans. Robert Edsel is an oil man turned historian, and he's an historian with a passion, the fate of art during World War II. His first book was Rescuing Da Vinci. Then he produced a documentary film, The Rape of Europa. His next book was the bestseller, The Monuments Men, which is now becoming a feature film. His new book is Saving Italy, The Race to Rescue a Nation's Treasures from the Nazis. He's joining us today from his home in Dallas. Welcome to The Reading Life, Robert.
Thank you, Susan.
I love your books. They are the best of both worlds. They have the pacing of thrillers, nonstop action and suspense, and they're all true. This is just an amazing topic, isn't it?
It is. Thank you for the compliment. Yeah, it's remarkable that some 65 years after the end of World War II, there's this major story that we don't know, but it's an incredible story of these men and women, museum directors, curators, art historians, and artists who saved all the great cultural treasures of Western Europe during World War II from the destruction of war and theft by the Nazis, a new kind of soldier charged with saving, not destroying.
That's very inspiring, I think. And you were an unlikely writer. Am I right in that? You came to this writing business after selling your oil company.
Yeah, I think that unlikely is putting it mildly. I moved to Europe and settled in Florence. My son was 3 years old, the same age as one of the key heroes of our book, Saving Italy, Dean Keller, who left behind his three-year-old son. And I started studying art and architecture and got interested in that. And I couldn't see at the time the parallel paths that my curiosities were taking me, both about art and architecture and then studying about history. And I had this epiphany one day walking across the Ponte Vecchio Bridge, wondering how, in the face of the most destructive conflict in history, 65 million people's lives lost, that so many of these works of art survived, and who were the people that saved them? And I didn't know the answer, but I was really curious to find out, and I just kept digging and digging and realized, you know, this is a huge story with very contemporary applications today when you consider the aftermath of the looting of the National Museum of Iraq and Baghdad and the fact that it only took us 60-some-odd years as a nation to lose the moral high ground that we worked so hard during World War II to establish. And, you know, that's really what my motivation was.
And then when you set out to write The Monuments Men, you wrote so much you finally had to stop and break it into two books.
Not surprisingly. I mean, we tried to count one day how many books there were on just D-Day alone on the invasion of Normandy, and we were, in the hundreds. And that's just one day out of the war. Now, it's an epic day, but when you consider all the museums in Europe are closed for a period of 5 years, millions of works of art and cultural treasures being moved over bomb-cratered roads, it's an epic story. And there haven't been the kind of books written about that, the volume of books that one would expect. And, you know, I think the public's just as fascinated and curious about this as I was, because I've been traveling around the country speaking to people and have been doing research now for more than a dozen years, and I've never had anybody stop me and say, oh, I know that story, you know, I don't want to hear about it anymore. Rather, people are curious and want to know more details.
Absolutely. So tell us about these two men at the heart of Saving Italy. And you said you feel that particular closeness to Dean Keller, who left behind his three-year-old son.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, Keller's 42 years old, as I was 42 when I went to Italy. Of course, he's going over there to be in combat. He's a portrait painter. He lived in Italy for 3 years as a student between the wars, as a professor of art at Yale, leaves behind his three-year-old son, Dino. He is very methodical. He loves the Italian people. He likes art, but he's not an art historian that likes to continually study things. And in contrast, and it's an interesting contrast I bring out in the course of the storytelling, you have a 29-year-old budding art historian, Fred Hart. Any of your listeners that have had a course in art of the Italian Renaissance may well have had Fred Hart's textbook, because it's still the standard book used in schools today. Fred Hart loved all things Italian, in particular works of art. He's a young, impetuous, very idealistic man. He likes the Italian people, but it's the works of art there and the artists that created them that have provided so much happiness and satisfaction in his life. And he goes over there on a mission to try and save these works of art. And the distinction between the two men and their ages, one having fought these battles of idealism and having learned that you've got to pick your battles, and the other still full of vigor, feeling like every single thing should be saved. It creates conflicts for them and challenges for them working together in Italy.
Now, one of the most charming things in Saving Italy are these cartoons, these drawings that Dean Keller sent home to his son Dino.
I'm glad you picked up on that. Dean Keller is not only just going to war and leaving behind an incredible career, as all these monuments officers did. Their average age was 40 years old. Hart is the exception at 29 years old. But Keller leaves this great job behind. He leaves his wife behind, and he has to leave his 3-year-old son behind. And he goes to war. He's a senior monuments officer attached to U.S. 5th Army. And he's still trying to figure out how to be a good dad to this boy he's left behind. And he realizes he can't read. He's a copious letter writer to his wife. So he decides he's going to send drawings. And he sends dozens of them on birthdays, on Christmas mornings, trying to capture in his imagination what it would be like if he was there. Oftentimes, the drawings include both he and his wife in them, even though he can't be there. And it's an incredibly touching form of trying to be a father from 4,000 miles away, continually through the war with all the difficulties he's got. He never loses sight of wanting to do the best he can do in his absence.
Oh, I absolutely think readers will fall a little bit in love with him as they read this book.
These drawings just melt your heart.
They do. They really do. Now, Florence, where you lived for those 5 years, is really at the heart of Saving Italy. It seems to have set a new course in your life in many ways.
Well, it did. You know, the truth be known, we ended up in Florence to get away from the heat of Rome and moved up there during the summer in August, September, and just rented some homes and liked it a lot. And it's a much smaller city than Rome. It's not as overwhelming as a bigger city like Rome. And there are a lot of American colleges with campus representation there. There were 29 when I was there. I hear it's up to over 40 now. So you have a lot of college professors there. And it was a very comfortable city for me to begin learning about art and architecture in an informal way. And it's so ironic because for the years that I lived there up until 2001, the idea of the Monuments Men and pursuing that story was little more than an idea. I was continuing to read about it and was curious and was doing some research, but the idea of writing books about it had not occurred to me yet. And yet, when I returned there over the last 4 years, off and on, doing research specifically for this book, I found myself going up to the house that I used to own. Next door was a garden designed by a monuments officer who was a landscape architect before the war. The home and building next to us had suffered artillery shell fire on one of the corners of the building. The German parachute division that was responsible for blowing up the bridges was housed in this hotel next to us. So I had monuments men and their story all around where I was. I just never knew it at the time, and it was ironic to do this research and go back and rediscover it. And it really, I mean, it's hard to imagine being more passionate about these guys, but I got even more connected to them knowing I was literally walking in their footsteps.
Absolutely. And so you're just back from a visit to Berlin, right, for the filming of The Monuments Men?
I've been over there twice on the set and headed back over there again in the first part of June.
And what's that like to see this story on film coming to life?
It's an incredible experience. I mean, you know, for me, my goal in writing the books was always to see a film made, because no matter the success of a book, you can't possibly reach the worldwide audience that you're trying to reach without film. And to get a film made, aside from a lot of hard work and luck, you got to have a great story, and it's got to be a people story, because that's what people want to see. They don't want to see a documentary. They don't want to see a history lesson. They want to have a gripping human interest story, and I felt from the outset and continue to feel this way that the story of the work of the Monuments Men in Northern Europe, as told in my last book, the one that is being made into a film by George Clooney and his cast, and my new book, Saving Italy, about what they did in Italy, that they're incredible, incredible stories, the most amazing stories I've ever heard, involving the David and the Last Supper, the near destruction of the Last Supper, and so on. So my objective has been the work of protecting the legacy of these monuments officers and then putting it to its best use through the work of the Monuments Men Foundation. And that means raising public awareness, and I think probably a billion people will end up seeing this film, and that's a game changer for anybody that's doing work in the area of art and the protection of art during times of conflict.
Oh, I can't wait. And you're also a trustee of the National World War II Museum, which is such an important part of New Orleans. How long have you been involved with that?
This will be my fourth year, beginning my fourth year as a trustee there. I also serve on the executive committee. The National World War II Museum is an extraordinary treasure of our country. It is a comprehensive telling of the American story in World War II, both in Europe and the Pacific, in ways that few places, if any, succeed in bringing the story to life through film, through exhibitions, through the macro and mini artifacts that they've got, through human interest stories. It's a deeply personal experience for visitors, and it's an engine for the city of New Orleans and the region. But this is our nation's World War II Museum. This is not, you know, I sometimes get concerned when we pigeonhole it and say the National World War II Museum in New Orleans, because there is no other National World War II Museum. There's just one, and it happens to be in New Orleans for a variety of reasons, designated by an act of Congress. So this is an incredible honor for the city of New Orleans and the state of Louisiana, and for all Americans and visitors from all over the world, an extraordinary opportunity to visit a museum that comes to life because of things like Beyond All Boundaries, this unique 4D film made by Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks, the leadership of Nick Mueller and his remarkable team there at the World War II Museum. They continue to find ways to push the envelope in making this museum. It's always educational, but it's fun and it's interesting, and people go there, and I can tell you, like, and I can speak for all the trustees, you go and you figure there's an hour you've got, you're going to go look at something you haven't looked at, and 3 hours disappears and you haven't even scratched the surface, even as familiar as we are with the museum. So I encourage anybody in your listening area that hasn't been there, you are in for an experience you will never forget, heading to that museum and being around docents there who are World War II veterans that'll walk you around and tell you about what their experience was.
Oh, it's so true. We're all so proud of it. And I remember when it was just kind of a gleam in Steve Ambrose's eye. You know, it's kind of a wonderful thing.
You know, it's a great example, and mine to a different degree, of the power of an idea. I mean, when I sit there and think, in 1997, sitting on that bridge wondering how all these works of art survived and who were the people that saved them, the power of an idea here 16 years later being made into this feature film, and now there'll be hundreds of millions, if not a billion people, finally know how these works of art were saved and who the people were that saved them. And the World War II Museum will, sometime in the next few years, be building a permanent exhibition for the Monuments Men. That will be the first exhibition of its kind in the world that will recreate a salt mine and allow visitors there to know what the experience was like as much as we can recreate it. So it's been a great partnership over and above my work as a trustee between the Monuments Men Foundation and the World War II Museum to make sure these heroes' story is also told there at the museum.
Oh, that's fabulous. Well, thank you so much. And you can meet Robert Edsel Thursday, May 30th at the National World War II Museum. Reception at 5, presentation at 6, book signing at 7. Should be quite an evening. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
The idea of the alphabet book has been around for a long time, but every now and then, one comes along that's really special. Today, we'll be talking with the creator of Love Letters from New Orleans, a very adult, very striking alphabet book about our hometown. With us in the studio is Nessim Higson, the book's designer. Hello, welcome.
Hey, Susan.
This is a gorgeous book. I mean, it's all black and white and gold, so we're prepared to love it right away. So tell me about the beginning. Tell me about thinking about this.
So it started with, there was actually a creative collective here in New Orleans that I was a part of, and probably about 4 years ago, a bunch of designers, photographers, illustrators all got together around a table, and we talked about doing a project together. And that project was an alphabet book, at least that's what we came up with. And I have actually in this old sketchbook a list of words, and next to each letter, someone's name is associated with it. And unfortunately, the collective kind of disbanded, you know, from lack of energy or whatnot. And one thing I found in my career is that, you know, if you really want to do something, you just have to do it. You know, you have to get the energy and push it. Right around that time, I met a really, really talented young photographer by the name of Damon Gardner here in town. And he was the kind of protege of Lee Crum. And Lee Crum, in my opinion, is one of the best photographers I've ever worked with.
Great photographer.
So I met Damon, and I basically gave him a proposition of, hey, do you want to work on this book with me? You know, why not? You do the photos, and I'll design it. He said yes. So we worked off the kind of initial list and started to kind of slowly pick the pieces. He had already had a few photographs that we were able to use. Jay is for Jazz. He had shot the Hot 8 Brass Band. So we were able to use a few things. As we started to work on the book, one of the things we wanted to establish was that the book was going to be for tourists and locals alike. We kind of had to make that determination. Is it going to be for locals or is it going to be for tourists? And we wanted to do both, which was really difficult. It's a really, really hard thing to do. So we enlisted the help of Anthony Vacaris, who's, again, an extremely talented writer I've worked with over the years. And Anthony came up with a brilliant idea of, why don't we do haikus?
Mm-hmm.
So he began writing haikus for each letter. And he also helped with the overall concepting of each letter and what we were going to do, et cetera, et cetera. And what we kind of quickly found out is what was a really nice thing. It was lots of ahas happening in the creation of a project. And what we found out is as someone flips through the book, they start to read the haiku, and it begins to be a little bit of a guessing game. You know,
right,
it's like,
it is.
What is this? Is this?
Mm-hmm.
And oh, that's what it is. And originally, it was also going to be a oversized tabloid. That's why it was black and gold, to limit the cost. And we're going to leave it around the city for free, so anyone in any coffee house could pick it up. Again, you know, after year one, after
well, that's
year
certainly
two,
changed.
You know, we've been working on it, I should say, for it's over 3.5 years. We realized that we wanted to leave more of an artifact, in a way, than something that is basically going to fall apart over time, because news, that's what happens with newsprint, unfortunately. So,
well, one of the things that's so interesting to me about this book is that very often books like this turn out to be design pieces, primarily. You know, the images are rich, they're mm-hmm. very beautiful, but this one has such layers in the writing, in the choices
yeah.
of what the letters stand for, in the photographs.
Yeah.
You can go back and reread and relook,
yeah.
and you roll right into it again. You know, if you open this book at any spot, you'll start turning the pages.
Yeah, yeah. I have a 3.5-year-old, and the book's inception was prior to her birth. And usually when you work on a project that long, when it's done, you don't really want to see it. It's, you know, he's kind of like, okay, I'm done. I'm on to the next thing. But fortunately, you know, even when I took the books finished out of the boxes, it felt great. And I still feel really good when I flip through the pages, and it all feels really refreshing.
You have a wonderful picture on your website, imalwayshungry.com, with the books in the box.
Oh, yeah.
I think everybody who does a book loves that feeling.
Yeah. When you first unpack them.
Yeah.
Well, funny enough, the cover of the book wasn't supposed to be the cover. The cover of the book was actually the heart. I think it's the second page after when you open up the end sheet. And through the printing process, it's one of those things where we were sitting there, you know, fine-tooth comb, going through everything. And, like, the biggest thing that I missed was that was actually the first page, not the cover of the book. So when I got all the finished pages delivered to me from the printer, because these books had to be bound in San Antonio, so I got all the finished pages. Now we're going to ship it to San Antonio.
Right.
And I had that realization, oh, no, this actually isn't the cover anymore. So I had to scramble and redesign the cover. But I think we're all really, really happy with the way it came out.
So how many people were involved in this total?
A lot of people. There are four main people. Myself, Damon, the photographer, Anthony, who was the writer, and then I had a really talented designer by the name of Lizzie Margiotta, and she's actually living in Los Angeles now, working for a really top-notch motion firm.
So, and you raised funds for this publication on Kickstarter.
On Kickstarter, yeah.
So how did that work out?
It was a lot of work. That's what I would tell anyone. I think Kickstarter is an amazing platform, so if you have a great idea, my biggest recommendation is have the product finished pretty much before you try and kickstart it.
Right.
A lot of people try and go on Kickstarter without a formulated – they have an idea, and it's not formulated yet. And I think Kickstarter is giving more recommendations of have it pretty much finished.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're, you know, with a lot of digital or tech pieces, a lot of people will go to Kickstarter without a prototype, per se. Then they'll get it funded, and then they find out that when they go to get it prototyped, it doesn't work. So we had the book pretty much done, and it was work. I will say that. It was a total of 30 days. We had a window open, and I was emailing people and badgering people on Facebook about 2 hours a day, every day, for a few weeks. But it's great.
The end justifies the means.
Yeah, we exceeded the funds that we raised, but we wouldn't have printed what we did without the funds. So
tell us about some of the choices you made. Give people an idea of why this is an adult alphabet book, and tell us about some of the choices that fell by the wayside, too.
Well, yeah, we actually have, if you go to loveletters.from.nola.com, there's a section on there that's DOA, Dead on Arrival. And that, I think there are four basically finished spreads that we didn't use. For example, we had A is for andouille, B is for beignet, C is for crawfish, and D is for dry fruit daiquiri. And C and D got killed.
Mm-hmm.
Through lots of conversations between the four of us, we realized that, you know, we didn't want someone to open up the book and go, oh, this is a
food
alphabet book,
book
for
yeah.
food. So we changed C is for crawfish, which was one of my favorite ones. We actually had a fake Times-Picayune mocked up with C is for crawfish typeset on it and crawfish on. I mean, it was the real deal. To C is for cemetery, which was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And D is for decadence, which is one of my favorite ones
as
well.
Of course,
yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. And that's a good example as well. D is for decadence, originally it was going to be either N is for neglect or D is for decay, which happens here,
yeah.
But in a nice way. And that's with both authors and also the people who we were talking with for locations. That was my argument was, don't look at it as a negative thing. It's actually a good thing. But we ended up going with D is for decadence just because it was an easier thing to understand.
Well, I like that N went from neglect to nonstop.
To nonstop. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
There's a certain measured energy there.
Yep.
So what's your story? How long have you lived here?
I'm born and raised. I grew up in the Irish Channel. So my dad's British. My mom's from southeastern Louisiana. My dad always has told me it's a sticky place.
It is a sticky place.
And I've done a fair amount of traveling. I've been fortunate to see the U.S. and go to larger cosmopolitan areas. And then also we've been living in Holland for a bit. And you get to see the unique culture here.
So where can people see this book?
So you can see it at Octavia Books. It's at Garden District Bookshop, Friend, which is on Magazine Street,
mm-hmm.
Spruce, Green Serene. Our studio is right above both of those places. Dirty Coast has it. Lost and Found in the Quarter has it as well.
And you wanted to tell us about a launch party coming up.
Yes, May 30th from 6 to 8. We're going to have a launch party at the studio, which is 2041 Magazine Street. And we'll have information on our Facebook.
Oh, that's great. So. We've been talking with Nessun Hixon, whose new book is Love Letters from New Orleans. Check it out. It's one of the most beautiful books I've seen in a long, long time. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Elizabeth Becker discusses and signs Overbooked, the Global Business of Travel and Tourism, Wednesday, May 29th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Catherine Campanella signs Legendary Locals of Metairie, Wednesday, May 29th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Robert M. Etzel, discusses and signs Saving Italy, the Race to Rescue a Nation's Treasures from the Nazis, Thursday, May 30th at an event at the National World War II Museum. Reception at 5, presentation at 6, book signing at 7. Today's guest, Nessim Hickson, one of the creators of Love Letters from New Orleans, appears with other contributors at a launch party Thursday, May 30th at 2041 Magazine Street. Check out loveletters from neworleans.com for the time. Chris Champagne, Kelly Harris, Jonathan Klein, and Valentine Pierce read a poetry night at the Alvar Branch Library Thursday, May 30th at 7. It's time to start thinking about summer reading, of course, and the New Orleans Public Library is getting its summer reading program off to a great start with kickoff parties Thursday, May 31st at 1 p.m. at Central City and the Martin Luther King branches, and at other branches June 1st. Check out neworleanspubliclibrary.org for detailed information or call 504-292-4803. The Martin Luther King branch kickoff will feature a Busta Rhyme rap contest Friday, May 31st at 1 with celebrity judges Shorty, Ayana Molina of the Melanated Writers Collective, and the 89 Boys. Rosemary Donnelly discusses her new cookbook, Cooking with a Cougar, Tuesday, June 4th at 6 at the Old Metairie Branch Library at 2350 Metairie Road. SOLA, the South Louisiana chapter of the Romance Writers of America, is offering a one-day workshop on self-editing with editor and publisher Liz Pelletier of Entangle Publishing. The workshop takes place Saturday, June 22nd at Andrea's Restaurant, 3119th Street in Metairie. It's by admission and registration ends June 10th. For information, check out solawriters.org or email Dawn at dawnchartier.com. This summer, the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities will host Tuesdays with Earl, a lunchtime reading series for professionals in the Central Business District. Participants are invited to bring lunch for a conversation about The Earl of Louisiana, the 1961 book by legendary author A.J. Liebling. Discussions led by historian Carolyn Cobb. The one-hour sessions will take place every Tuesday at noon from June 18th through July 16th at the Louisiana Humanities Center, 938 Lafayette Street. Enrollment's free but limited to 40 people, and books will be provided. For more information or to sign up, contact Brian Boyles at 504-620-2632 or boyles@leh.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.